Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Richard Burris, Senior Fellow Emeritus at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and author of We the People, The Story of Our Constitutional Convention, The Bill of Rights, James Madison's Legacy, and The Documents of the American Revolution. The topic of his talk will be War Stories from the White House. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, April 12, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Randy Adkins, chairman of the Department of Political Science at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
Let me begin by telling you a little bit about Mr. Burris. Mr. Burris is currently a senior fellow emeritus at the Hoover Institution in California. He's the author of We the People, The Story of the Constitutional Convention, The Bill of Rights, James Madison's Legacy, and Documents of the American Revolution. Mr. Burris is a graduate of the College of Arts and Sciences of the University of Omaha. That was 1944. He also holds a JD from the University of Iowa and his LLM from the Graduate School of Law at New York University. Mr. Burris is a veteran of the Marine Corps, where he served as a second lieutenant in World War II, where he fought at the Battle of Iwo Jima. After World War II, Mr. Burris served as a special agent of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and as deputy assistant general counsel of the National Labor Relations Board. Then he got involved in politics. And from 1961 to 1963, Mr. Burris served as counsel to the minority on the Education and Labor Committee in the House of Representatives. From 1965 to 1969, Mr. Burris served as the counsel to the Republican leadership in the House of Representatives and director of the Republican Policy Committee in the House. From 1969 to 1971, Mr. Burris served as deputy assistant for domestic affairs to President Richard Nixon. And then in 1973, late 1973, and most of 1974, Mr. Burris served as counsel to Vice President Gerald Ford for domestic and legislative affairs. And sometime in the middle of all that, he found time in 1968, 1972, and 1976 to be assistant to the chairman of the Republican National Convention. So would you guys all join me in welcoming back Mr. Richard Burris? So we're just going to do this as an interview, and we're just going to have a conversation here. And then after we get through a few of my questions that I've got for him, we'll have an opportunity for everybody else to ask questions too. I had the pleasure of interviewing Mr. Burris and doing what you would call an oral history interview for a number of hours yesterday. So I've heard most of the answers to these questions, and I picked all the good ones to ask him again. So first, Mr. Burris, tell us how you got involved in politics. How did that get started in your life?
Well, it's a real story of networking, making friends, and then just seeing what happens. And one job, one friend would lead to another. And for the most part, it seemed to lead to Washington, D.C., and different jobs in Washington until I finally left there and became an academic. That was my downfall. But I used to make a good, clean living as a politician. But that's a joke. But then I stayed. Out at the Hoover Institution, which is part of Stanford University, for 30 years.
So when you were a student here at UNO, were you very involved in politics?
A couple of things. Should I tell this or not? Today, when I was had breakfast with the chancellor, I was telling him about being a student at a time when the regents decided to kill the football program. And so the students didn't like that idea one bit at that time. And we went on strike. And it was so successful that the Regents reinstated football. But there was only one problem with that. By that time, the war was starting, and all the real football players had gone off to war. So now the dean of students turned to me and said, okay, Burris, you and your bright ideas, you got football, now you got to play football. So I had to go out and get on the team and get my fraternity brothers, my other friends, to come out to make up a team. So be careful what you wish for.
Now, when you were a student here at UNO, you entered right before World War II.
Right.
America entered World War II. Yeah. What was that like in that first week after December 7th of 1941?
Well, it really started on December 7th, which was a Sunday. And I was hiking out north of Omaha. Hummel Park, is it still there? Okay. I was up there, and as I came back, some of my buddies were working on a car, and they said, hey, Berth, have you heard? No, I hadn't heard anything. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor. And so I said, I knew they'd go after the Philippines. I knew absolutely nothing about the Pacific. I'd never even seen the Pacific. So that was the start of the war for me. Then the next day, over in the old building, we gathered together in the auditorium and sat there and listened to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, president, talk about a day that shall live in infamy, and war was declared, and all of us sitting there looked at each other and thought, this is our war. We're all going to be involved in this, no question. So then it was just a question of how you were going to be involved. Was it going to be in the Marines, the Air Corps, the Navy, the Army? A lot of my buddies decided the Marines would be good for them. They were probably like me. We knew nothing about the Marines, but we saw they had great uniforms, and the girls liked them. So that seemed like pretty good recommendation as far as we were concerned. One of the guys is sitting right here. I got to introduce him. Bob Cunningham, who was here at the university with me, and Bob left to become a Marine flyer, and he flew through the Pacific during the war and then came back here, finished at the university, and then went in the insurance business and, lo and behold, entered politics and became mayor of Omaha for a while. So Bob's been a dear friend ever since. His wife, Tupper. Next is Marie Stitt, the widow of Bob Stitt, who also left here to become a Marine flyer. And then Marjorie Loring, who married our best friend, Russ Loring, who unfortunately died a number of years ago. So it's wonderful having you people here.
So World War II was very big for your generation. And it was obviously very big in terms of your career. Tell us what you remember most about World War II.
Well, as I said, everyone had to, within the next week, literally, decide, well, where did they want to fight? It wasn't a question of were they going to fight, but where were they going to fight? Which branch of the service? And so a number went into the Army. Many became flyers with the Air Corps, which is part of the Army in those days. Others went to the Navy, but a whole bunch of us, as I indicated earlier, decided for the Marines. I didn't realize that for most of the Marines, that was infantry. And we were signing up to be second lieutenants, platoon leaders, wherever that might take us.
And so where did you end up fighting?
Well, after training, boot camp, Paris Island, then some time at Pendleton, then out in the Pacific to the 4th Division, which had just returned from Saipan, Tinian, and was getting ready to go to Iwo Jima, along with the 3rd and 5th Divisions. The Marines had 6 divisions at that time. 3 went to Iwo, 3 went to Okinawa.
Okay. And obviously you came back from there and safely, and we're glad you did.
I was lucky.
And then you went to law school after that.
Yeah, as you go along, you just sort of fall into things. I came back with, really, my ambition was to join back up with Bob and the two Bobs and play golf and drink beer, frankly. And so I made a mistake. I visited my brother over in Iowa, and he noted that they had a pretty good law school up at Iowa City. Why didn't I go up and just check it out? And might be interested. So I went up, went in the dean's office, and was standing there. I was still in my Marine uniform, and I was saying, well, I don't know what I want to do, really. I might be a history professor. That was in the cards. I'd talked to old Doc Thompson about that. But he discouraged me by taking me to a window and pointing over to, is it Fair Oaks across the
Fair
way?
Acres. Fair Acres.
Fair Acres. And he said, see over there, Dick? Yeah, I see it. All those big houses? Yeah, I see them. There isn't one professor living there. But there are a lot of attorneys. So keep that in mind. So anyway, when I was standing there at the dean's office talking and saying I hadn't made my mind, I didn't know what I was going to do. I hope I didn't talk about drinking beer and playing golf. And this head stuck out of the door. And lo and behold, it was the dean. And he came rushing out. He said, Lieutenant, we've got a great class starting here in 1 month. June, and you have to be in it. Sign here. And I said, oh, wait a minute. I've got these plans, big plans. And he said, no, this will be the best class. Everyone will be a veteran. Sign here. So I signed there, and I was in law school on the accelerated course. 2 years later, I graduated.
And we're glad you did. So it
That's
was
a professor saying, I'm glad I did as a lawyer.
Now, we have many students who are lawyers, who go on to be lawyers. It was a number of years. You worked for the FBI, and
right.
Then you were working for the National Labor Relations Board, and then you came to work on Capitol Hill.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about how you came to work on Capitol Hill.
Well, I finished 5 years with the FBI as a special agent, and the best thing that happened to me there, I was on an assignment, and I didn't know it, but as I was waiting to interview a person, the door opened, and in walked a young lady by the name of Jan, and she turned out to be, in 6 months, my wife. So that's how I met my wife, in New York City. And it was a great thing for me, and I think for her, too. So after that, I went back and got my master's in law, then down to the NLRB as assistant general counsel, and then out to Lockheed in California, first at the Missile Division in Sunnyvale, and then down to the headquarters at Burbank. I always wanted to live in California, and so did my wife. Great opportunity. Lockheed was one of the premier manufacturers of airplanes in those days, so I handled labor relations for them and other matters as an attorney. We were happy in a new home in Woodland Hills. when my friend from NLRB days, Ken McGinnis, came. He was out in California. He dropped by and he said, Dick, how would you like to come back to D.C. and be the Republican counsel on the Education and Labor Committee? And I said, well, yeah, I've always been interested in politics, so I think I could do that. And he told me there's one little drawback. The minority leader, a wonderful guy by the name of Carol Kearns from Erie, Pennsylvania, had a drinking problem. But he was a marvelous client. He came to trust me completely. He followed my advice, and we established a good relationship. He followed my legal advice, and I wouldn't drink with him.
And so you stayed there a couple years. And then you went back to the private sector for a little while, right?
Right. Those were the days Adam Clayton Powell had just become chairman of the committee. John Kennedy had just been elected. So it was a sort of a bad time for Republicans, a great time for Democrats. But that was a wonderful job. Gave me the opportunity to be on the House floor working with all the legislation that was coming in. All of the education legislation came before the committee at that period, along with much of the labor law. And one piece that we Republicans never got as much credit for as I think we should was equal pay for equal work. To me, it was the greatest advance the women had made, maybe ever, because up to that time, every union contract had, for instance, male assembler, female assembler, and the female assembler always got less money. Tellers in the banks, if you were male, you got one pay. If you were female, you got a lesser pay. And on through the whole structure. And when that bill was passed, it changed all of that overnight. So that on the basis, if you did the equal work, you got the equal pay. And I thought that was one of the best things that happened for the women of America.
I think most women would agree with that.
Good.
So
what's your vote then?
So you came back after a brief time away,
right,
and worked on the policy committee and was counsel to the leadership.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about some of the personalities that you worked with. I know you said you worked with John Rhodes and Jerry Ford and some other
right.
people.
And Mel Laird. It was following the disastrous 64 election when the Republicans Goldwater had led us to a magnificent defeat. So at that point, the Republicans believed they had to do something to get going again. And the something was to remove good old Charlie Halleck from Indiana, and he was a good man. But they wanted a new face, a new vision, and they selected Jerry Ford from Grand Rapids, Michigan, who'd been in the House since 1948, made him the ranking member, and John Rhodes from Arizona as the head of the policy committee. So that's when I really got to know Jerry Ford. He had the respect of all his colleagues at that time, and he and John Rhodes and Mel Laird and some others helped to rebuild the Republican Party, certainly in the House of Representatives.
So, one of the things you told me about yesterday was these alternative proposals right. that you were responsible for on the Republican Policy Committee. Tell us more about those.
Well, unfortunately, the Republicans had developed the no philosophy. A piece of legislation would be introduced by the Democrats, and the Republicans' response they believed it was bad legislation. It was no, and it was no, and it was no again. And so under John Rhodes and Jerry Ford, and I was working as their attorney, we decided it was bad, we'd say no. But if we said no, we should say why, and even more important, we should have a Republican proposal, alternative. So we developed what we call constructive Republican alternative proposals. Unfortunately, everything else in Washington and has like the NLRB, AAA, so we ended up with CRAP, which was both good and bad. It made people pay attention, at least, to what we were putting out there. And so that is what, under Ford's and Rhodes' leadership and the Republicans, Bob Griffin was also a member of that group, we would put out the constructive Republican alternative proposals for this legislation. Sometimes it would be an amendment. Sometimes it would be a whole piece of legislation. But we were standing for something other than just being against something.
One of the things we talked about yesterday, too, was your work on the 25th Amendment.
Right.
You were there on the Hill. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was there at that point as a counsel to the leadership, too. And so the 25th Amendment, which had been kicked around for years, finally came to a head. Because if you remember in your history, Woodrow Wilson, for 2 years, last 2 years of his presidency, was really completely out of it. And his wife and doctor ran the presidency. And then with the illness of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that caused more concern. And so they felt, and rightfully so, there should be a procedure where two things. First, when a president became incapacitated, he could be removed from the office until he became able to handle a job. He could do it either voluntarily or involuntarily. Then the other aspect, someone brought up and said, well, when the president dies, the vice president becomes president, but then we don't have a vice president. What's the process? We should have a process. So we developed the process for naming a vice president. And that was interesting for two ways. First of all, it was almost a throwaway part of the 25th Amendment. The big discussion was, okay, who should nominate the new vice president? Finally decide, well, the president always selects the vice president, so he nominates. Then what? Well, he should be confirmed. And the Senate immediately said, that's easy. We confirm everybody. We'll just confirm the vice president. And the House said, wait a minute. This is two houses up here. So they then agreed that it would take a majority vote of both the House and the Senate. And so that was enacted, passed the states, and became the 25th Amendment.
And so then you left there for a little while.
Right.
And in 1968, you were working on the platform committee at the Republican National Convention. What was that job? How did you get that job?
Well, because, again, it was a spinoff from being on the policy committee and counsel to the leadership, because Ford, under the Republican arrangement, as minority leader of the House, became the chairman of the convention, Republican convention. So that, then, reaching out, he made me and one of my best buddies, Hyde Murray, to come up and on their platform committee. So we help put together the platform for the Republican Party in that.
Anything you're particularly proud of about that platform?
Well, we were able, abortion then as now was a big problem. So we had hearings where both sides came in, testified for the need to have something in the platform about abortion. They were giving a respectful hearing, and then we carefully kept it out of the Republican platform. Unfortunately, it got back in a few years later.
Now, you ended up in the White House very soon thereafter. How did you end up in the White House?
Well, again, when Nixon was elected, his whole focus was on international foreign affairs. And frankly, he really didn't think much about the domestic programs. And so when he got elected, now, following the election, he had to put together a program when he'd become president, a domestic program. And he asked Arthur Burns to come up and head up a group in the Carlisle Hotel to put together a domestic program for the new Republican president. So they were looking for someone who was familiar with programs, and having been on the platform or the policy committee, I'd been working in that area, so I was invited to come up and join Arthur Burns.
And why did you leave the White House?
Well, first of all, I got in the White House because Nixon appointed Arthur Burns as counselor and put him in charge of the whole domestic program. And he turned to me and wanted me to come and be an expert again with him down in the White House. And that's how I got to the White House.
Okay.
So networking and getting to know people is really important as you go along in your life and in your career, because you never know where that's going to turn out.
So you left the White House for a while, from 1971 to 1973. And then tell us a little bit about how you got back into politics.
Well, fortunately, when Arthur Burns left the White House to go over and be chairman of the Federal Reserve, that was one place I wouldn't go. I knew absolutely nothing about monetary matters, economics, etc. So I stayed on. Ehrlichman became the assistant to the president for domestic affairs. I worked with him for a while, and then someone had to fill the role of counsel to the president. And a number of my friends, and they really were my friends, were trying to get me in that job. But instead, they chose John Dean. So John Dean became the counsel to the president. And at that point, I left and went to Hoover.
And so getting back into politics, though, how did you get back into politics?
Well, when Spiro Agnew got into trouble and was forced to resign, then Nixon had to come up with a vice president candidate under the 25th Amendment. Nixon wanted John Conley of Texas. That was his choice. But the Congress, led by the Speaker Albert, a Democrat in the House, told Nixon that they would never confirm John Conley. So they, Nixon asked, well, who would be confirmed? And they said, there's really one person, and that's Jerry Ford. The Democrats trust him, like him. Republicans trust him, like him. If you send his name up, he will be not only nominated, but confirmed. And that, so at that point, they wanted someone back in Washington who'd had experience under the 25th Amendment, who could work with him to get Gerry Ford confirmed. And because I'd worked on the 25th Amendment, I was the expert. It's like all the time I was back there. Because I was from Nebraska, I always got put in charge of the agriculture programs. Anyone from Nebraska, of course, knows all about agriculture. I really didn't. But I handled the programs anyway and was glad to do it.
So you ended up staying with Vice President Ford for a few months.
Right.
Right. What was it like in his office during Watergate?
Well, it was a most difficult time, not only for the nation at that point, but a difficult time for Gerry Ford. He was like a man and his staff that I was a part of then on a tightrope. He didn't want to appear that he was anxious to get the job of president and to push Nixon out. But on the other hand, he didn't want to be taken in to that mess either. So he, I thought, did a darn good job of staying independent without being openly disloyal to Richard Nixon.
And what was it like in the first few days of the new Ford administration after the president had resigned?
Well, everyone could see it coming. It just seemed like it wasn't would it happen, but when would it happen? And finally, as the time went on, it became like a death watch. You're just watching a person slowly die. That's what was happening to Nixon. And everyone knew that it was going to happen, but when would it happen? It finally happened when Barry Goldwater and John Rhodes, who took over from Gerry Ford as the minority leader, got a group of Republican House members and senators, and they walked down to the White House and went in to see Nixon and told him, "It's over, it's time for you to leave." And so he did. And Ford's walked to the helicopter. That was a terrible day. Waved goodbye unto Nixon. And then they turned around and came back into the White House. And to me, this is where you just got to have faith in our system. It worked. Nixon flew off to California. Ford came back into the White House and was sworn in as President of the United States by the Chief Justice. Not many places would something that drastic happen that quickly and that smoothly.
And so for the first month or so, what was it like in the Ford administration?
Well, it was a tough period because, first of all the old Nixon people who I knew, and a lot of them I really liked, were still sitting in all the chairs. They were occupying the job. So the first decision that Ford had to make, was he going to keep on the Nixon people, or was he going to fire them all? And incidentally, that was the advice that Lyndon Johnson gave. He always felt he made a mistake when he didn't fire all of the Kennedy people and that they were never really loyal to him. So the recommendation to Ford was fire him. Ford was too good a guy to do it. After all, these were people. They were had worked hard, loyally, had families, so he said he wasn't going to do it. And he kept most of them in place, with just a few of us moving in from his vice presidential staff. And that's the way it worked for months. He slowly, the one person he felt in the high office that he really needed and had to have was Henry Kissinger. And so he kept Henry on as Secretary of State. And I think that was a good move. Henry had a lot of admirers and detractors. Henry's a difficult man, but he was a brilliant man, too. He also acquired, unfortunately, the Secretary of Defense. His name was Schlesinger. And Schlesinger was a professor by trade. And he had totally alienated the whole Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike. So one of the first things I got when I went up on the Hill to talk to some of the members about Ford's program was the senator jumped from his chair and said, I want you to tell Gerry Ford, you have to tell Gerry Ford this. Do not fail. He's got to fire Schlesinger. So that's the message I carried back. Hi, Mr. President, you got to fire, if you want anything up on the Hill in the Senate, you got to fire Schlesinger. So he did, which was necessary.
Mm-hmm. So 31 days after President Ford took office, he pardoned President Nixon.
Yeah.
What was that like? That had to be a very difficult decision.
Well, first of all, leading up to it, Nixon had trouble. Ford had trouble, a lot of trouble. If you remember, Vietnam had just been concluded terribly. There was total unrest. The budget was out of whack, of course. And he couldn't, inflation was rampant, and he couldn't get anyone, especially the press, to fix on the immediate problems. All they wanted to talk about, all right, Mr. President, are you gonna pardon Nixon? When are you gonna pardon Nixon? Why don't you pardon Nixon? Are you mean you're not going to pardon? You know, at every press conference we'd go around, he was hit with that barrage, and he finally just got sick of it. And he made a decision, and he came in one Sunday and told his staff, I've decided I'm going to pardon Nixon tonight on television at 5 o'clock. I don't want any argument from anyone. It's done. Just do the necessary work you have to do to get television here, and let's work on the statement I'm going to use. And so that's exactly how it was done. I understood later that Ford called his good friend Tip O'Neill, who was then Speaker of the House, and told him, I made the decision, Tip. I'm pardoning Nixon tonight at 4:05. I want you to know. And Tip said, too soon, Gerry, too soon. That was the old politician speaking, that it was just too soon after Ford had taken over. And that led to all kinds of comment, accusations, that there had been a deal between Ford and Nixon, that if Nixon would leave, if Ford would pardon him, there was no deal at all. But to try to convince, especially the press, of that fact. And his approval rating, shortly after Monday, went from 72% down to 32%. And it obviously had a big impact on his failing to get elected in 76.
So speaking of 76, Well, actually, before we get to 76, you didn't stick around the Ford White House very long, but no. You continued to work for him for a little while.
Right.
What did you end up working on?
Well, again, because I was an expert on the 25th Amendment and getting people confirmed, like I was an agriculture expert. When Ford named Nelson Rockefeller as his vice president, now he had to get confirmed. So I was detailed to work with Nelson Rockefeller and his staff from New York City in getting Rockefeller confirmed. The first thing I did was sit especially his staff down, which was first rate. They're really good people. And explain what was going to be demanded of them. One, a complete disclosure of all financial contracts, arrangements, family, too. So the Rockefellers had a big meeting of their family and decided that they would agree that Nelson could disclose for the first time the extensive holdings, interlocking relationships, etc., of the Rockefeller family. And then, to make this possible, they hired one of the biggest accounting firms in New York City that then became working on it full-time, one of the biggest law firms in New York City. They started working on it, and they put together the information that Nelson Rockefeller was then able to take before the House and the Senate, which won him the confirmation, which he wouldn't have gotten otherwise. I always admired him for that.
So you left politics and went back to the Hoover Institute.
Right.
But you came back out of retirement for a little bit in 1976 to help at the Republican Convention.
Right.
And I know you got a great story you told me yesterday about how you got Reagan and Ford together. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I don't know how many of you even remember the 1976 convention and the race for the nomination between Ford and Reagan. And Reagan was reluctant to get into it, but he finally got into it, and then he was into it full steam, and it became a real horse race, so that he came into the convention almost in a dead heat, which was amazing. But Ford won by a few votes, frankly, because he knew a little bit more about the process than the Reagan people did. So the convention was completely split. They would have the Ford people at one end and the Reagan people at the other end, and when Betty Ford would come in, they'd play the Michigan fight song and everybody stand up and throw their hats in the air and cheer. And then Nancy Reagan would come in at the other end and they'd play California, Here We Come. George Murphy, incidentally, was emceeing all this. It was a grand show, except it was getting meaner by the minute. So finally, when Ford won, and he was coming to the platform with his acceptance speech from his hotel, it was apparent that the convention was split right down the middle. And both sides were mad. And the only thing that could happen would be if Reagan would come on the platform and say something to help heal, bring the party together. And in politics, you can't win if you don't have your party together. So John Rhodes was then chairman, and we talked. And he said, we got to get Reagan down on this platform. I said, well, okay, let me try. And I'd seen Bob Griffin sitting out in the audience and Bob Griffin, senator from Michigan, was Ford's floor manager. And I went down and talked to him. I said, Bob, what do you think about Reagan? He said, we got to have him here. We got to put this thing together. And how can we do it? I said, well, to my knowledge, there's only one way, and that's it. Ford would personally invite Reagan to come down and make a speech of some kind, help heal this terrible divide. And so Griffin said, okay, how do we do it? I said, well, there's a White House phone underneath the platform here. Let's go back there, and you can call Jerry Ford. He called over there and got Cheney on the phone. And Cheney said, well, we tried, and the Reagan people wouldn't do it. So it's all over. Jerry's about to leave for the convention hall. It's too late. And Griffin said, let me speak to Jerry. And Jerry did get on. And Griffin explained the situation. And Ford said, well, I'm all for it, but how can we do it? And Griffin said to Ford, well, if you will personally invite Reagan down, he will come down. And Ford apparently asked Bob Griffin, well, how do you know that? And he said, because Dick Burris said so. I thought, oh, boy, now I'm in trouble. But it's true. Ford came to the convention hall. He was dancing around after making one of the best speeches of his life. And as he came around, he said, is Reagan in the house? And we could look way up. They had Reagan in the worst seat possible, way in the back, and you could see Nancy's red dress. And just assume, okay, Nancy's there. Reagan's got to be there. So I said, hey, he's right up there. And so as Ford came around, he went up there and said, like this, come down, Governor, come down. And Reagan, sitting up there, turned to his people and said, what's going on? And they said, I think you're being invited to come down. And he said, I am? Yes, you are. That's what Ford's doing. So Reagan said, well, if I'm invited, I guess I'll go. So he got up and came down, and then he was introduced, and the place just exploded. And he gave, again, do any of you remember that? Probably not. But there was impromptu. He gave one of the greatest political short speech, but he said it all. And he just brought the convention out of its chairs. Many of them thought at that point, unfortunately, we'd nominated the wrong people, wrong person. But he did it. And later, when I was trying to figure out how could he have done that, here he was sitting up there. He had no idea he was going to be called down. And I finally figured out that he did it because that was his acceptance speech that he was going to give if he'd been nominated. So he was ready with it, and it was a great moment.
So we're about to conclude here. In thinking about the White House, what would you have the students in the audience take away from your talk here about the White House and all the stories that you've told?
Well, I've been in two White Houses, maybe three, and observed others carefully and talked to a lot of people who have been in other White Houses. And I think the only thing that changes in the White House are the people, the faces. And they come and go, but the structure of the White House stays exactly the same. You've got the president up there, and everything else is a pyramid down. And They're all struggling to get as close to the White House or to the president as they can. They're working much too hard, probably 20 hours a day, 7 days a week. They're doing the best they can. But the one sure thing is, sooner or later, everybody leaves the White House. So my advice to anyone who's on their way to the White House, who wants to be in the White House, have a plan B. Have a fallback position where you can go when your time in the White House is completed. But if you have the chance to work in the White House, for heaven's sakes, do it. It's an absolutely most thrilling place in the world, and you'll enjoy it and appreciate it later. Thank you.
We're gonna take a couple of questions here, just a couple questions. So is there anybody who would like to ask a question? So.
Hi, I'm Mike. If you had gotten the job as White House counsel, the job that John Dean got, how would you have handled that? How would you have given counsel to the president without getting yourself indicted in that mess?
You know, I've been asked that question before, and I've thought about it. And my first answer would be, thank God I didn't get the job. I would have thought that I could have done it better, but I doubt it. Frankly, I think it was such a mess, and anyone, as you know, the number that were arraigned, convicted, and jailed was tremendous. I'd like to think that I could have done something positive, but I thank the good Lord that I wasn't put in that position.
My name is Alex. My question is, first of all, thank you for coming on behalf of all of us and everyone for putting this together. My question is pertaining to throughout your entire life. It's, I think, clearly evident to all of us that you've maintained a positive attitude and been open to anyone that's come across your way. How would you characterize the way you've maintained your foundation, your principles, while still being able to work with both sides of the political spectrum throughout it all?
Well, first of all, do your best not to make enemies, because none of us are Daddy Warbucks. If you remember the show Annie, and someone was saying how badly he treated people, and he said, look, it doesn't make any difference if you're never coming back down again. But the fact is, you're going to meet those people again, and they can either help you or hurt you. They can either be your friend or they can be your enemy. And it's through friends that and networking that you have the opportunities. And the jobs, the opportunities will lead places you never dreamed would go take you. But if you've sort of gone step by step, you find the opportunity comes, and you're able to handle the opportunity. So that would be my advice. Just where was it? You got signs out somewhere saying, practice kindness. And that's certainly true. Be kind to people. They'll appreciate it. You'll do a lot better yourself. Okay.
Mr. Burris, thank you so much for coming. Everybody join me again in thanking you.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Richard Burris, Senior Fellow Emeritus at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and author of We the People, The Story of Our Constitutional Convention, The Bill of Rights, James Madison's Legacy, and the Documents of the American Revolution. The topic of his talk was War Stories from the White House. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, April 12, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Wendy Townley, Assistant Director for Media Relations at UNO, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.